Hi everyone, welcome to the third episode of the EFL Magazine Business Podcast. Welcome back, and today's guest is Rachel Roberts. Now, Rachel is an ELT entrepreneur and also a life coach and therapist. She works with clients one-to-one in her 12-week small group program for ELT business owners, trainers, teachers, entrepreneurs, to switch off stress and switch on success. She's 30 years experience as a teacher, trainer, materials writer, psychotherapist, counselor, and coach. Her website is liferesourceful.co, and I really enjoyed speaking to Rachel, and I hope you enjoy the program.
Hey everyone, buckle up for a new episode of the EFL Magazine Business Podcast, the one and only podcast made to help you launch your business or take your existing business to a level of success you could never have imagined. Whether you're a school owner, freelancer, publisher, or other entrepreneur, you're sure to pick up lots of actionable advice when you listen to the EFL Magazine Business Podcast. Remember to visit EFLmagazine.com for great articles and features. Without further ado, here's your host, the founder of EFL Magazine, Philip Pound.
Hello, welcome back everybody, and I'm really delighted to have a guest today, a new guest on our EFL Magazine Business Podcast, and it's Rachel Roberts. Rachel, how are you today?
Yeah, I'm pretty good today. The sun's shining for once. It's been raining for what feels like about 2 months at the moment here in the UK, but today the sun is shining, so I'm hoping to get out later for a walk with the dog.
It's good lockdown weather.
Yes, exactly. When you can't get outside and you're in lockdown, it's really not good.
So how are you coping with the lockdown situation?
Well, to be honest, because I work from home, I haven't really, you know, there's not a massive difference for me personally, because I spend quite a lot of time in my office as it is. I guess the biggest impact has been upon my kids, really. I've got two teenagers who are 15 and 18. So they're doing GCSEs and A-levels, or not, because the exams have been cancelled. So, you know, there's a lot of anxiety about all of that, I guess. But I would say I haven't been, you know, impacted as badly as a lot of people, because I've been able to continue doing what I do. So I'm lucky in that sense.
Good. So there's anxiety about not having exams.
Well, the problem is it's the uncertainty, because what will they have instead? And I think that's the biggest issue in many ways with the whole COVID situation, is that we're all dealing with massive amounts of uncertainty, and the human brain just doesn't deal very well with that. Basically, we like to believe that we have control over things, even if the reality is actually that we generally don't have as much as we think we do.
We'll talk about that a little bit later. It's the lack of control. I can think myself when I worked back home in Ireland in 2008, 2009, you know, what they call here in Japan, Lehman Shock, or the financial crash, meltdown, whatever. Mm-hmm. And at that time, working in a company, you see managers coming in and out, and you say, oh, the big managers are coming in. Then the CEO is coming in more often, and they're having all these meetings. So, you know, are our heads on the chopping block? You know, it's the uncertainty really brought a lot of stress. And I think at that time, you know, I'd felt stressed before. I'd been working in sales jobs that I actually knew what toxic stress was, you know, and it does feel very different. So for people, you know, originally we were told that, you know, stress is a bad thing. And there's a lot of new thinking on it that some stress is good for us. So tell me your experience and understanding of dealing with stress and what stress is.
So, yeah, I mean, obviously stress is one of the, well, perhaps not obviously, but stress is one of the key things that I deal with in my coaching work with people. And it's also something, you know, I have personal experience of. I burnt out in my career twice, back in the 90s and early 2000s. And that was really what kind of started me on my path, I would say, to kind of understanding myself better, like why this was happening. And then from there, how to help people. And absolutely, stress is not in itself a bad thing. It's simply a physiological response to threat of some sort. And, you know, very often you need that. I mean, certainly if you are genuinely under threat, you need it because you need to be able to run away or fight or whatever. But also it can be a good thing to have that sort of level of adrenaline. You know, I mean, I'm talking to you now on this podcast, which is, you know, making me slightly more anxious than I would normally be. And therefore I have a bit more adrenaline. And actually I can use that in a positive way. But when it becomes, the point is, I guess, that we are supposed to get a burst of adrenaline to deal with the situation and then let it go. And the problem is that very often we never let it go. We just get another burst and another burst and another burst, and it all builds up kind of within our system. And we get to the point where we can't kind of switch off because our body believes that we're under some terrible threat.
Are we addicted to rage? Is that, you know, I'm particularly thinking about social media.
I think we're addicted to kind of stimulation, if you like. And, you know, we get sort of hits of certain chemicals when we are, you know, receive these kind of, when we get notifications, for example, on social media, that immediately gives us a hit of dopamine, which is a kind of feel good chemical. And we can get used to having these sort of high levels of either dopamine or the stress chemicals like adrenaline and cortisol in our body. So in that sense, yes, I think, you know, we can kind of become addicted because we get used to feeling very sort of switched on, if you like, all the time. But I think, you know, I think the thing about social media, I mean, I think there are a lot of good things about social media, but that and media in general means that we are constantly exposed to the whole world, if you like. And we're not really built for that. You know, we're built to deal with, I don't know, you know, to give a rather cliched example, you know, there's a saber-toothed tiger in the next village, you know. So you hear this piece of news, it gives you a jolt of adrenaline and you do something about it. But now we're hearing about these threats all the time from all over the world. And I think our bodies find that very hard to deal with. And, you know, same with other emotions. If you're constantly on social media comparing yourself with what others are doing, that'd be kind of overloading your system and making you anxious. So, you know, I guess we have to police ourselves really and limit our consumption is what.
So how do we do that? I mean, I've heard some advice. One is graying your screen, maybe putting your apps on page 2, 3, 4, taking the native apps from your smartphone, have some kind of net nanny that monitors or reduces your time on social media. What would you recommend?
I think, you know, it depends basically kind of how addicted you are and how good your self-discipline is, I think. You know, definitely, if we want to change any habit, we need to make it easy for ourselves to change that habit. And so, you know, if you're finding that your sort of, you know, fingers are kind of subconsciously heading to those apps, even without you knowing it, then yes, you should either leave your phone in another room or take the apps off the screen or, you know, whatever's going to reduce the friction, if you're easier for you not to do that. You know, I tend to, for myself, I tend to go on I use social media a lot for my business, but I tend to go on at specific times and for a specific length of time. And I kind of, you know, literally time myself, go away again. And I don't have notifications on, so I don't get that sort of ping, ping, which is totally designed to make you addicted.
I came across a new, a couple of new phrases to talk about for using social media. And one was using it passively and using it actively. So passively is, you know, you're just browsing, looking what people are doing. And actively maybe is maybe a little bit more like what you're doing is for your business. You're posting things, you're you're replying to comments or you're commenting on things that are, you know, relevant to your business and mm-hmm. profile that you want to put out. Would that be your understanding? Is that the way you would use it?
Haven't used that way of looking at it specifically, but I can see, you know, that works. I guess it, for me, perhaps the word I would use is like conscious use, you know. So are you consciously making a decision to go on and take various actions, which could involve reading something of somebody else's, which I guess would be passive? Or are you is it just totally automatic and subconscious and you're not really in control of it? And you look up 3 hours later from your scrolling. And kind of
I just watched it last night. It was on a BBC documentary, so it must be true. So so tell me a little bit. We'll go back a little bit there. You mentioned burnout, and you'd experienced this yourself. Mm-hmm. What is burnout? What does it feel like? Yeah, what is it?
I mean, essentially, it is kind of when stress gets to the point where you can't kind of recover easily. So, I mean, you can literally, to some extent, I did literally burn out, as in my adrenal function was affected because there was so much adrenaline in my system all of the time. And what can happen is that kind of gets to a sort of a point, a peak, if you like, and then it stops working properly. And so I then kind of had problems with chronic fatigue and that kind of thing. So it can be that bad. I mean, stress, you know, some people anyway think that stress is, you know, not really that serious and something that can be solved by a week's holiday but if it gets to the point of burnout, then often it can't, you know, physically it can take months for your body to kind of come back to where it was. So, you know, it's really important, I think, to spot the signs, which would be, you know, things like, I don't know, constantly catching colds and things, sleep, irritability, or sometimes, you know, people go the opposite way and they just become very disconnected and cynical and just not wanting to engage with, you know. So it shows itself in different ways in different people.
It reminds me of, you know, you meet the guy the first day you're working in a job and you're all excited, a little bit nervous, you're meeting new people, and, you know, the guy comes up to you and he says, you don't want to work with this company, everybody is terrible and the job is awful. So, you know, people, I think those people suffered burnout long ago and they've just been, they've kept going throughout the years. But we didn't call it burnout back then. I mean, the whole approach to mental health now is so much more positive, isn't it? It's you know, that people can suffer these episodes and the help is there, the recognition and the acceptance is fantastic. Have you seen that in your time in
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I think definitely when it happened to me, I think there was very much a perception that it was a kind of weakness. And I think people are beginning to really get now that actually it's usually kind of like the really tough people that suffer from burnout, because they're the ones that just keep pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing until they can't anymore, if you like. You know, so it's certainly, you know, not a question of being weak or lazy or you know, in any way sort of less mentally strong than anybody else. If you push anybody's system too far, then, you know, it will crack.
So what you're saying is the more type A personality maybe could suffer burnout more than...
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. And that's one of the things, you know, that when I'm working with clients that we're looking at, because often people are kind of driven by beliefs and messages that they've kind of had since childhood, you know, about I mustn't let anybody else down. You know, I must always put other people before myself. You know, those kinds of messages taken too far are what leads to burnout, basically. And there's a lot of that kind of thinking with teachers in particular.
I'm sure. Yeah. I can just say the same in Japan as well. I mean, there is the obligation to the other, but, and even here in Japan, I think in the last year, 6 months, the attitude towards mental health has really improved. I mean, it's still far behind, and there is the attitude, oh, some person has taken time off work, they're weak or something. But I think there's been some notable celebrity suicides here in Japan, maybe 2-3 people. And all right, some of it was cyberbullying as well, but you know, it's kind of a wake up call. So it is a positive thing. And how do you think this has been discussed before, but your take on COVID and the unique challenges it brings?
Well, I mean, I guess, you know, it's I don't know whether the challenges are exactly unique, but we're getting them all at once at a very high level, if you like.
Yeah.
You know, so we've got lots of fear, which is obviously always around, but it's really heightened. You know, people are physically afraid, you know, for their health and for the health of those that they love. They're also frightened about the future, financial insecurity and that kind of thing. There's also isolation. Lots of people, you know, are literally isolated from anyone else. And even those who are together with their family, that's not always a good thing. You know, there are lots of women who are stuck with abusive partners, and indeed the other way around, you know. So that's, you know, that's another massive problem. And I think just generally the total uncertainty about what's going to happen, when it's going to finish, you know, just when the next kind of period of lockdown is going to end, when people are going to get vaccines. You know, I mentioned before, but we all, I think, as humans really like to kind of think that we know where we're going. You know, we ask in job interviews, we say things like, where do you see yourself in 5 years' time? And, you know, and we plan holidays like a year in advance. And actually, this is a reminder that we can plan those things, and a lot of the time we'll get lucky and they may happen, but there's no control over that. There's no guarantee ever, you know.
Yeah.
And that's a bit of a sort of existentialist moment of like, oh, actually, you know, life is not as secure as I thought it was.
Yeah, and it's the fact, it's probably an evolutionary thing that when there's a plague or a virus, it's unseen, it's hidden. And anybody could have it. I mean, it kind of reminds me a little bit, and it maybe this was playing on this evolutionary trigger, the whole McCarthyite thing. And, you know, we saw a lot of TV programs in the 60s about people that were different and invaders. I remember there's a TV show you used to show, and they'd one different finger, and they were aliens living amongst us. You know, it's very much the whole McCarthy, I think. So it's a fact that there's a disease. We don't know who has it. If we have it already in our system, like the invasion of the body snatchers. It's frightening.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're absolutely right. That is definitely an element.
Yeah, I mean, go back to the early 80s when we worried about nuclear war. I mean, that's a bit better, I think, than this. But
but marginally.
Marginally, yeah. Tell me a little bit about your practice and how you started out. So we rewound and we saw you were working for a company. You were burned out and you decided to make this, let's say, a hero's journey. You one day, was there a flash of inspiration or some resolution that, you know, say, I have to do something? Or how did that come about?
Well, you know, I would say, yes, there kind of was, but it took me a really long time to get to that point of deciding to do it. So I actually trained as a counsellor and psychotherapist like nearly 20 years ago now, which was as a result of sort of, well, first of all, the burnout, and also I think realising I was working at the time as a manager and as a teacher trainer. And I realised, you know, more and more how important interpersonal skills were. So that was kind of how I started getting into that path. But then I sort of didn't do anything with that for years, really, other than using it professionally in my work as a teacher or teacher trainer or manager. And then in 2008, I became a freelance ELT materials writer full time. I took voluntary severance from my job at the time, which was the one that had contributed somewhat to my burnout, though I recognized that I also contributed to it, and started working like essentially for myself as a freelancer. And I found, you know, over the years, I found that actually I quite often was helping people in that kind of way, informally, but I still kind of didn't take the step until 2017, when I decided actually this, I think this is really what I want to be doing. You know, so it felt to me like a lot of what I'd done before, like the teacher training and the manager, it's all about people. It's always been about people. That's the part of being a manager I liked. I certainly did not like, you know, preparing for Ofsted inspections and things like that. So I kind of realized this was the path I wanted to take. So I went back and did a coaching diploma at the University of Warwick, which is the same place I'd done the counselling diploma, and started kind of looking for clients. But initially, I was not focused on people in ELT at all. I, like most people, I think, starting out in a business, I didn't want to niche. I wanted to help everybody, and it took me, you know, probably 6 to 9 months and the help of a business coach to realize that actually, you know, this was the my niche, if you like, working with ELT professionals.
And you mentioned it in your previous job that the job had given you burnout stress, but then you said that you also did. So we mentioned about locus of control, things that are within our control, things that are not within our control. So how do you see you contribute to that? And this was something maybe within your control. So how could you have done things differently?
Oh, I mean, I think, you know, as I mentioned briefly earlier, we all kind of bring all sorts of, you know, unconscious beliefs and patterns and messages with us that affect how we deal with things. And so absolutely there were aspects of the job that contributed to it. And, you know, that's nearly always the case with people that I work with. So I'm not kind of, you know, giving employers a free ride here. However, there were also aspects of how I dealt with it. So lots of times when I didn't set firm enough boundaries, when I kind of, you know, went above and beyond myself because I felt guilty or because I felt I should or because I felt that, you know, that was my duty, whatever. So I had to kind of address those. I think also things like, you know, fearing that I would be criticized or seen as not good enough, or, you know, so I had to address all of those things as well, because actually, if you don't address those things and you just leave the job, as I discovered, they just come back to bite you in the bum again, you know, unless you're very lucky with your employer.
And would it be fair to say, a lot of our listeners will be school owners and entrepreneurs in ELT, and we obviously can't put brushstrokes over people, but generally in education, people have, if we talk about the five traits in psychology, that, you know, ELT teachers, people are quite open, aren't they? There's the trait openness, isn't there? And the downside of trait openness is really boundaries, isn't it? That sometimes people in education, they're obliging and they want to look out for others, but sometimes they don't know when to say no.
Absolutely. And I would say, you know, that's nearly always the case with clients that I work with, that they struggle with that. Sometimes, you know, it's that they don't want to upset or offend people or look like they can't do the job properly. Sometimes, it's even just kind of like over-enthusiasm, you know. So one of the things that I often say to clients is that learning to say no is not just about saying no to the things that you don't want to do. It's also saying no to some of the things that you do want to do. That will mean that you don't then have time for other things that are important.
That's an important point. Mm-hmm. I think we mentioned this last week. But anyway, we were talking a little bit about choosing. And I think with a couple of guests that I had, and we talked about entrepreneurs, they see new ventures and they say, oh, I'll chase this, I'll chase this one. But it's very much the same thing as a psychiatrist once told me, said that choosing is losing. You know, that you have to be prepared. Isn't that the root of the word decide, isn't it? You have to kind of kill everything else to do it. So we want our cake and eat it, don't we? So if you were to talk to somebody, but someone was like, and it's a root of indecision, isn't it? Generally, I know there's a lot, I brought up a lot of things there, but for somebody that has maybe indecision or feel a little bit stuck, how would you work with them on that? What would you?
Well, I mean, I am a massive believer in taking action. So, you know, taking imperfect action, as they say. So, you know, very often procrastination at its root, it's about fear. So, you know, it's fear of making the wrong decision, or fear of being exposed as not knowing what you're talking about. Or it can be a kind of sort of resistance. You know, that you don't actually want to do something, but you don't want to say that you don't want to do it. So you put it off. But I think, you know, the answer always, and this is certainly what I do myself, you know, is just to do something, see what happens. And generally, you know, if it's working, keep doing it. If it's not working, think of another way of doing it and just keep moving forward.
The mind has a lot of tricks though, doesn't it? I mean, we say, oh yeah, I'll do something. So instead of doing that, I'll do something completely useless, but I'll stay busy.
Yes, well, that takes us on to prioritizing, which is another issue.
Tell me a little bit about prioritizing.
I mean, I think this is absolutely key. And I mean, particularly, I think when you run your own business, because when you're employed, very often those decisions about what's a priority are not yours. You know, somebody tells you what to do. And particularly if you've been a teacher and you've been employed and you've been kind of managed. Of course, teachers do have some autonomy, but you've been kind of managed. It can be quite hard to suddenly literally have to be your own boss and to make decisions about what you're going to do. And what people often tend to do is to kind of pick off the low-hanging fruit, you know, so they'll spend a day thinking about a logo or on another day taking some nice headshots, you know, and none of these things are really very important. So, you know, it reminds me of, you know, the sort of Eisenhower's four box matrix.
Oh, yeah.
Have you come across that? Yeah. You know, so that for those people listening who haven't, you know, it's the things which are important and urgent, important but not urgent, not urgent, not important, which would be the logo, or urgent but not important. I think I've got that the right way around. But essentially, the idea is that people tend to avoid the second box, so the important but not urgent things. But that's where we should be putting most of our energy. So the things that are urgent and important often go into that box from the non-urgent box because we procrastinate. But if we consciously try to focus on things that are not urgent but that are important, that's where we see the change. So you see it with things like, you know, exercise routines, for example. I mean, that's never urgent, right? But it is important. And if you wait till it's urgent, it's probably a bit late.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if a doctor comes back and you see you have X amount of time, if this doesn't happen, or you're pre-diabetes, or, you know, that's a wake-up call. But still, it doesn't prompt some people to stop, does it, or to change their ways. So how do we change habits?
Well, the first thing, and this may sound completely obvious, but you have to really want to change it. I think, you know, a lot of the time, actually, people don't. So, for example, I said I would be careful about talking about clients. So I'm thinking about what to say. But I had a client who wanted to give up smoking. And a lot of the, you know, we could have we could and we did look at like practical steps, but a lot of the issue was that deep down, subconsciously, this client did not want to give up smoking because of what it represented. It represented kind of freedom. It represented an opportunity to escape from their work. Mm-hmm. You know, so until we really pinned down what it represented and kind of really looked at those beliefs and like, is that really true? You know, do you really believe that? It wasn't, that was why it had never been successful for that person to give up, because they could try all of the strategies in the world, but there was that deep unconscious belief that actually was a great thing to be doing.
You know, the smokers, I'm not a smoker, but, you know, work in companies, the smokers get 10 minutes an hour, don't they? A cigarette break. Nobody else gets that. So there are payoffs.
And social payoffs as well.
Yeah.
If you go out and smoke with other people, you're part of that gang, you're cool, you have something in common, you know, so that's a huge payoff. So you've got to address all of that kind of stuff, I think, which is not to say that there aren't practical things as well. As I mentioned earlier, like, you know, smoothing the path is certainly a key thing, like making it easy for yourself rather than difficult.
So tell me a little bit more about smoothing the path.
So for example, if you want to get into a habit of exercising every day, then, you know, put your gym kit by the front door where, you know, so you won't have to search for it and think, oh God, it's too late now to make that class anyway. This is in the days when we could actually go to classes, you know, or if you want to write in your journal every night, put it on your pillow in the morning, you know, so that it's there and makes it easy for you. If you're trying to eat more healthily, don't have, you know, drawers stuffed full of unhealthy food that's easy to go for. You know, if you have to have it, put it somewhere where it's not easy to reach, and then at least you'll have that moment of thinking about it. So, you know, so I think that's a key thing. Another thing would be not trying to do too much at once. So very often people set themselves incredibly high goals, and I think there's a kind of subconscious self-sabotage there because they kind of know they're not going to be able to do that. And then they can go, well, I tried. You know, so very small steps add up.
So it's something similar to, there's been a couple of books recently, Mini Habits, Atomic Habits, this sort of thing. It's trying to get a little bit under the ego depletion radar or the decision fatigue. So try to, try to work with those
Absolutely.
Things.
I mean, actually, I have a group on Facebook, Lightbulb Moments, and we have a book group, and we're actually reading Atomic Habits at the moment. We're going to be discussing it next week.
Oh, fantastic.
It's a great book, I think.
It is. I read the Mini Habits a few years ago, and Atomic Habits, I think, is even better. And some of the chapters is really great. I actually must read it again. And a friend of mine here, I suggested it to him, and he started playing the piano again. Like, he just touched the key. I said, you know, in Atomic Habit, or was it Mini Habits? I can't remember. You open the lid and you touch the keys, and then you're like, okay, I'm here now. Maybe I'll do a little bit more, or do one press up a day. Isn't that what they say as well in Mini Habits or Atomic Habits? Have you tried yourself any of these?
Not press ups, no, because I've never been able to do even one press up. But certainly in terms of, small kind of habits, like, you know, just, I mean, walking is a big form of exercise for me. And, you know, another thing that he talks about, which I think is useful, is like not breaking the chain. And so, you know, like you say to yourself, right, every day, you know, and I've got an Apple Watch, you know, every day I'm going to close those rings, and I'm going to do it for, you know, every day in a row and not break that. And that's it. I find that anyway, extremely motivating, you know, even though it's nuts really, because actually who cares, but you do care at some level.
There is a satisfaction ticking those boxes, isn't it? And before the interview, I said we'd talk a little bit about your system and to do not. So for entrepreneurs and, you know, people want to get things done, and we have lists in our head, and we, you know, on our app, and I have a notepad, and you know, to-do. So how useful are to-do lists? So some people say don't have one, just schedule. Some people say, oh, you have to have a to-do list. Or what's your opinion? What's your
I think you need to, you definitely need to schedule. But I think you have to have some kind of to-do list personally, because otherwise the brain kind of can't relax about those things. You know, so it's, I mean, it's called the Zeigarnik effect. Apparently it's sort of this idea that, if something isn't completed, the brain will keep reminding you about it. And usually that's at like 2 a.m. or something, like, you know, you wake up in a cold sweat thinking, oh God, I haven't done whatever. So having some kind of system where you know that everything is kind of safely there and that it's not going to be forgotten, I think is essential. And the one I tend to use, because I work from home and I'm sort of in my office, I do use post-it notes, because I will just slap it on a post-it note and stick it on the wall behind me. And then I know it's captured and I can kind of relax about it. And I have a sort of system whereby I kind of move them up. So they go from sort of do at some point to need to do fairly soon to doing now. And I never have more than three in the doing now block so that I don't feel overwhelmed, and then done. And periodically I get rid of the done ones, but I quite like to let them build up because it makes me feel good. You know, so whatever system you use, I think the key thing is you need to prioritize what you're currently working on, because what does people's heads in, I think, about to-do lists is the way that they can be really long and they never get any shorter. And they're not going to get any shorter because there are always going to be new things to add to them. And so that can leave us feeling overwhelmed. So just picking, like, those are the three I'm working on now and I'm not even going to think about the rest, I think is quite helpful. It's prioritizing again, actually, isn't it?
Yeah, prioritizing. So for entrepreneurs starting out, people, we mentioned a few things there. One is transitioning from more the corporate education environment where you're kind of compartmentalized and everything is structured and you know what to do. And then you're thrust into the entrepreneurial thing, whereas where, you know, if you don't do it, nothing gets done. You have to kind of, you're the buck stops with you. You have to do everything, and suddenly you have all these things. So how do you transition?
Well, I think the first thing probably actually for quite a lot of people is seeing themselves as a business owner or an entrepreneur, because I work with a lot of people who refer to themselves as freelancers. You know, that is different from other kinds of businesses in that you, it's like a B2C kind of approach rather than B2B. You know, you're working, a company is giving you work, but it's still a business. And I think often people don't actually make that shift. And they kind of see themselves as sort of employed, but at one remove. And so, you know, you're not employed, though, because you don't get sick pay, you don't get holiday pay, you know. So I would sort of say it's good to move away from that and see yourself as a business owner. And as a business owner, you have to allow time to work on your business. And that's the other thing I think that people often don't do. They spend all of their time working in their business, so doing whatever that business is, so writing, editing, teaching, you know, training, whatever it is, and they don't allow any time for working on the business, as in making plans, getting more known, you know, getting more visible, thinking about what you're going to charge, planning negotiations, you know, all the things that are part of running a business, as well as the practical stuff, obviously, like invoicing and things. They tend to do that, of course. But
oh yeah, I got used to that. That's okay. I actually got to like it. I never liked accountancy when I or any of these business studies when I was in school. But when it's my own money, I'm perfectly willing to do it. But I want to talk a little bit about pride and encouragement. Okay, you know, when you train to be a teacher or to be a therapist, the subject of pride comes up, doesn't it? And classically, you know, a lot of therapists will tell you not to praise, and maybe in teaching as well, don't praise the person, praise the action.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? So you did a good job, but not necessarily you're good, because they don't do a good job the next day, or I'm bad or something like that. So if for a client, for a teacher, or for somebody who is looking to hire other people and they want to motivate them, what kind of tips can you give?
Well, I certainly would agree that it's more effective to kind of praise, you know, the action, if you like, as you know, as much as, I mean, this is a sort of, you know, growth mindset thing, because if you are sort of saying, oh, you know, you're really good at this, then that does imply that that's a fixed quality and that, you know, you either are or you aren't. Whereas I think we all know ultimately as teachers that actually it's not like that, and that, you know, obviously some people do have more natural talent than others, but everybody can kind of learn most things if they learn it the right way and they apply themselves. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, it can be very motivating for people when they realize that actually they, I mean, you mentioned accountancy, you know, I mean, maths is definitely not one of my stronger areas, shall we say. Mm-hmm. However, you know, I have discovered that, yes, I can, you know, manage Excel spreadsheets and things like that. And I, you know, I can do things that I perhaps previously would have told myself, oh, no, you know, that's not something that I can do. I'm not good at. And that is very motivating, I think. Did that answer the question? I'm not.
It did. And that's a really good point you brought up about doing things you thought you couldn't do. That's a major part of being an entrepreneur and launching out is breaking through these barriers in your own head, these misconceptions, these things from your past that someone told you, or you attempted something many moons ago and it didn't work out. And, and suddenly found out, well, actually, you know, I'm actually quite good at this. I should have tried this a long time ago. Have you experienced that yourself as transitioning
Totally. Yes. I mean, particularly I would say it's sort of technical stuff for me. So, you know, setting up like a mailing list and getting, you know, people put into groups and setting up, it's like a sort of, I can't think what the word is, but when I studied computer studies back in the dark age, and you had to like create programs, you know, if X happens, then do Y kind of thing. And so setting that kind of thing up, it's very satisfying to find that I can do that kind of thing. Having said that, I do also think if it's something that you don't particularly enjoy and that you don't feel is your forte, you can always hire somebody else to do it. And I, you know, I do get help. I have a virtual assistant who helps me with the technical stuff, and it's great, you know, so I don't spend days and weeks trying to work things out when my time could be better used.
Okay. So coming more to the business side of things, you mentioned virtual assistant, and how do you... Tell me about your day. What does that look like? How do you like, send all your emails in one block and get it all done, eat the frog? Or do you multitask? Is multitasking not a good thing? Or do men and women, can men not multitask and women can, or is that a myth?
I actually think nobody can really multitask. I do think some people are better than others at, I mean, personally, I think there is no such thing as actual multitasking. We can only do one thing at a time, but what we can do is switch very quickly from one thing to another. And I think some people are better at switching very quickly from one thing to another. And I think I'm definitely better at that than my husband is, but I don't know if that's a male female thing or if it's just
same kind of here. Yeah, I'm not much of that, but my wife is, she's like 4D, 4D chess. Yeah, so. Yeah.
So I don't know, but that doesn't mean it's a good idea, is what I would say. You know, so just because you can switch quickly from one thing to another does not mean that you should, because you will do better work if you are more deeply focused on one thing. I believe that. You know, so this is the idea, like Cal Newport's book, Deep Work. So, that, you know, this idea of really getting focused for a period of time absolutely, you know, definitely you will be much more efficient and get much more done than if you're skipping about trying to do 79 things at once, however good you are at doing that.
For you, what did you take from that book or books about?
So basically, I think the key thing for me is I time block. So I do schedule. So I think scheduling is really important. So I tend to kind of, my days vary hugely. So, you know, I will have time for client work. I try to kind of put clients, you know, in chunks, if you like, so that I'm not sort of doing client, then something else, and so on. So I try to kind of group similar bits of work together. And I try to do, I believe in the eat the frog thing. So I try to do like the most demanding tasks when I'm fresh in the morning, not necessarily immediately, because I'm not necessarily immediately fresh. But, you know, that sort of key time, which for me is often like sort of, you know, 9:30, 10:00 till 12:00 kind of thing. That will be when I will do writing work. I might do another block in the afternoon, depends how much I've got to do. So in terms of sort of planning, I block out the time. I try to do similar things together, and I try to do the hardest things first, if you like.
Mm. Okay. What's your opinion of self-help?
I think it depends what you mean, really. Do you mean like self-help books?
Self-help books.
Well, again, you know, it depends on the book. I mean, I think some are great and very helpful, and, you know, I've learned a lot from them. Some are complete, you know, rubbish. I do believe we can help ourselves, for sure, but I also believe that sometimes it's hard for us to help ourselves because we don't see where the blocks are, and that's where working with somebody else can really help, because you get that perspective. And you get somebody kind of prodding you in those places that you don't necessarily want to explore, but that actually you need to.
That comes nicely onto my next question. How does coaching work?
Okay, that's a massive question. I think it works in different ways, you know, depending on the coach and depending on the person. So coaching is a bit of a catch-all, you know, so it can go right the way through from sort of mentoring and, you know, being quite sort of directive, which I would say is closer to the kind of work that I typically do on my group program, where I'm, you know, teaching people about like how to use social media or how to negotiate or, you know, how to generally set up and run their business. So that's kind of closer to mentoring, although there is some coaching involved there too, because the coaching for me is more about kind of, you know, following where the client wants to go, but coming in at appropriate points and asking the right questions so that they kind of are focused in on where they need to be. So how directive that is varies a lot from coach to coach. I mean, I was originally trained as a Rogerian person-centered counsellor, which is totally non-directive. And the belief, you know, the Rogerian approach is that you simply need the core conditions. So, you know, it's about having empathy, having unconditional positive regard, and being congruent yourself. So, you know, if you notice something in yourself, you'll say that, and the two of you kind of together work things out. And I do think that can be very powerful. I also think it can take quite a long time sometimes. You know, so these days I do kind of mix and match a bit more in my approach, and I will be, you know, more direct or directive at points if that seems appropriate. And certainly if we're talking about work related things, because I coach quite a lot on career and business as well, you know, then I will kind of say, you know, what I think has worked, or give advice, or, you know.
So tell me about working with entrepreneurs and what has worked, what their difficulties were and what has worked for them.
Okay. So, I mean, again, you know, it does vary. But I would say that for a lot of the people that I work with, there are issues around confidence, not being sure whether they really want to get more visible because they might, you know, get criticized or attacked. The sort of tall poppy thing, you know, what will people think of me? Will they think I'm showing off? You know, that kind of thing. There's quite often people struggle with imposter syndrome, you know, this idea that they're kind of getting away with it, but actually if people knew, you know, which of course...
Funnily enough,
you know,
Donald Trump never suffered from that, and he was an imposter. So there, you can take an example from him.
Exactly. No, I mean, the people who suffer from imposter syndrome never are. They're always the most conscientious people who are really good at what they do, you know, because the genuine imposters, yes, it never crosses their mind. Money, I think, actually, money is another big. So I think a lot of people, particularly perhaps teachers, because teachers are very altruistic often, feel guilty about charging money. They don't like to ask for more money. They worry that, you know, that they'll be rejected. They don't want to look greedy. You know, there are all sorts of beliefs around money which impact on them. And that often is a sign, I think, for me, that something shifted. I mean, I just got an email from one of the graduates of my last group program yesterday, actually, saying that this person, I'm keeping it really neutral, had got work booked in for the next 4 months as a result of becoming more visible, but also that they had negotiated a higher hourly rate for their work.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah.
You know, so that's like a really concrete, good, you know, like, my work is done kind of thing, you know, and that happens quite often, actually.
An investment. It was an investment, you know, they got something back from it, you know, monetarily. It's fantastic. Yeah, I think the money thing is really interesting. I think for me, being brought up in the 70s, 80s, and a lot of people as well, it's the same. That parents never talk to children about money. It was like, oh, you don't talk about these things. But I was listening to, I think it was the Money program on BBC Four. Maybe if it wasn't last week, it was the week before last. And it was the program was about talking to your children about money and teaching money in the classroom. So it was really excellent program. And they mentioned, the parents said, okay, well, this is what we're going to do. This is how much money we're going to give you. What are you going to... So the children automatically become more, you know, more financially aware, saving money, being accepting that money is just just a value transaction. It's not for work that's done. It's not, it's in no way indicative of the person's self-worth. You know, it's just a transaction. So I don't know what my point was there, but
we have very little financial education, I think, still. And that people's attitudes towards money can, you know, can be quite sort of funny, really. And when you actually sort of start to unpick them, a lot of people are really, you know, leaving a lot of money on the table, if you like, because they just don't want to ask. They don't want to try and negotiate. I mean, I had somebody else I spoke to told me about accepting quite a high powered job in another country. And just accepting salary that they were given because they had no idea like what that would be worth in this country. And then getting there and finding that actually they were earning less than lots of people quite a long way further down the scale than they were, you know, because they just had just never occurred to them to kind of negotiate on the salary or even find out, you know, what it was worth. So that kind of thing is pretty common, I think.
Yeah, I think so. It's unfortunate, but with your great work, I'm sure it's changing. So how do you change a person's attitude to money? They don't want to charge too much.
Again, I think it, practical steps. Well, I think it is about really kind of, again, it's about really uncovering what you believe or what you unconsciously believe, you know, so digging out, if you can think of things that, you know, your parents used to say to you, like if they always said like money doesn't grow on trees, or for example, you know, then there's a good chance that if you heard that a lot, that at some level you really believe that it's very hard to get money and that you have to struggle and suffer. And so you will kind of create that to quite a degree, you know, in your life. I know that sounds a bit woo, but, you know, we do create what, you know, what we believe. You know, if we believe that nobody likes us, then quite often that's what happens, because that's kind of what we're expecting from people. The same, I think, with money. If we believe, you know, that it's really difficult to get and that we're never going to have enough, then that's kind of what tends to happen.
So tell me a little bit more about your site. How can people get in contact with you? What's the URL? It will also be in the show notes. So for people who want to contact
you. My website is life-resourceful.com. And you can also find me on Facebook. As I mentioned before, I have a Facebook group, which is for sort of ELT professionals who kind of want to have less stress and more balance in their lives and work. And that's called Light Bulb Moments. So you can also find that, you know, join the group and, you know, get to know me a bit more through that as well. There's over 500 ELT professionals in there now. It's a great community. So I would recommend that.
Okay. We'll finish up pretty soon. But for somebody obviously engaging you as a coach, we can certainly recommend that. But for someone who wants to be more proactive about mental health, what can they do? Can you give some advice?
Well, I think we mentioned earlier about sort of boundaries. I think that's probably, you know, really a key thing. I mean, very often I think, you know, obviously, there are some genetic elements to mental health. However, I think a great deal of it is sort of at least triggered by situational things. You know, so there's a school of thought which I tend to subscribe to, which is that, you know, both anxiety and depression can be triggered by threat or a perception of threat, if you like, and it's just different ways of dealing with it. So for some people, they'll become very anxious about that perceived threat. For other people, they'll kind of shut down, which is essentially like what depression is. So I think, you know, being aware of the decisions that you're taking in your life, like where you work, who your partner is, you know, and how they treat you, both the work and the partner, can actually, you know, go a long way towards helping your mental health. The second thing I would say, and again, it's a bit of a cliche, but it's so important, is don't believe everything you think. You know, so people tend to, you know, assume fairly logically that because they are intelligent, logical people, that everything that they think is clearly also intelligent and logical. And that's not the case at all, because, you know, there are parts of our brain that are very, very primitive and that don't really have a clue what's going on in the modern world, and are just kind of going, ah, bear, you know, and perceiving threat left, right and center, and trying to protect us, but just not doing a very good job of it. You know, we mentioned books before. The Chimp Paradox is really useful book, I think, for understanding kind of why you shouldn't believe everything you think. And that in itself can make such a big difference to people, you know, when they realize that actually they don't have to believe those thoughts and that they can just kind of go, okay, that's my chimp talking.
Rachel, it was really fascinating talking to you, and I really enjoyed it. And I hope our listeners get a lot from it. And, you know, in the future, we'll be doing a lot more podcasts. And, you know, I'd like to invite you back. Maybe at some stage we can we'll be doing kind of panel discussions, maybe that we can talk with specific problems and give advice. So
I'd love that.
We'd be delighted to have you back. But for now, Rachel Roberts, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the EFL Magazine Business Podcast with Philip Pound. For more great advice and resources, check out EFLmagazine.com. If you found this podcast helpful, be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. See you next time.